Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
BT Sport Pods.
Hi, welcome to Michael Calvin's Football People. I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and by Paul Hayward, the author and columnist. I've also been to see David Moyes to gauge the value of his managerial experience. But first, Manchester City's renewed challenge for another Premier League title. City returned to the top of the table by winning at Arsenal, and with the Champions League on the horizon, momentum is building. Johnny, there was something ominous about the nature of that win at the Emirates, wasn't there?
I think there was. It was the performance of a team that knows how to win titles. It was the performance of a team that, in the image of their manager, doesn't give up anything at all, and is taking the attitude that if someone is going to rest supremacy off them, they're going to have to sort of rest it out of their cold dead hands, as it were, because they're going to fight every inch. And you saw Arsenal, I felt, in the first half, give their best. That's another ominous thing. You know, Arsenal were intense. They discomforted City. They threw a lot at them. They couldn't score. And then you saw Guardiola rejig things a little bit. City coming on stronger, finishing the game very strongly. And just little tells like, Arsenal bring on Fabio Vieira, who's a kind of hopeful signing for them. City bring on Phil Foden, you know, generational English talent, as it were. They've still got Julian Alvarez on the bench, a World Cup winner. John Stones is injured. And we've seen Arsenal wobble in the last couple of weeks, and we've seen City come on strong. We're used to City doing this in the second half of seasons. I know the points tallies are level, but Arsenal have got the game in hand. But I'd suggest that City are slight favourites now for the title, because we've known all along that if City could click into that Manchester City machine that we're familiar with, then they would take some stopping no matter what Arsenal's lead was. And the signs are that that's starting to happen.
What are the implications, or the broader implications, Paul, of that clicking into gear? When we look at the competitiveness of the Premier League, which actually, you know, should underpin any competitive process, you've got City, as I say, marginal favourites, to be kind, to win their fifth title in 6 years. Again, what are the implications of that?
Well, you used the word ominous, Mike. It's ominous for anyone who wanted to see the title race democratised, and it seemed to have been when, you know, Arsenal took this impressive lead. Liverpool have fallen away. Man City looked to be levelling off. And these two teams have maintained a duopoly over the last, what, 6 or 7 seasons. So there was a freshening up of the title race, I think, in the first half of the season. But now we're starting to look at a more familiar picture. It was remarkable the way Man City just switched back on against Aston Villa. They toyed with Aston Villa at the weekend, and then they were ruthless against Arsenal in exploiting the defensive mistakes, particularly by Tomiyasu and Gabriel. So it really felt like the old order had restored itself. I mean, it's a bit early to reach that conclusion because Arsenal have got a terrific mindset. They look a bit raw and inexperienced at that level, but, you know, they might fight back. We mustn't discount them altogether. But yes, it looks as if Man City have woken up to a threat and reimposed themselves. And of course, it's an interesting scenario as well because we've got these 115 charges hanging over Man City. So there's an extra moral dimension to it now. You know, we're used to the idea that Abu Dhabi's money and Pep Guardiola's brilliance and the talent of all these players would dominate the title race. But we've also got this, now we've got this extra kind of reservation about it on top of the general, you know, feeling of over-familiarity with it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't help the situation when you've got banners, 100-foot-long banners, proclaiming the genius of City's principal lawyer, does it? If we're talking about football as a one-party state, Johnny, what about the benevolent dictator, Mr. Guardiola? I'm getting the sense that this is now personal, it's not business.
That you mean in reference to the attacks, as he would say, on City?
That, and you know, the fact that obviously there's an obsessional side to his character which is coming out.
Yeah, there is. And I felt actually my colleague Martin Samuel made a good point in print today, which is that it's not just money and might that is behind Manchester City, but of course there's an utter genius of a manager. And I guess the question would be, what would this look like if Pep Guardiola was removed from the equation? That's what we don't quite know. Would Abu Dhabi dominance through those riches, would it actually be expressed in quite such a decisive way without, I think, the best manager around? I'd suggest probably not, but we are seeing Pep coming back, fighting as he does. He's a supreme competitor as much as being a great intellect in football terms, I think. He made bold Pep-like calls in that game last night, putting in Bernardo Silva in a kind of, I'm not sure if he was a left back, I'm not sure if he was a left wing back. It was just it was a kind of classic go everywhere and follow these tactical details, but don't actually worry about, you know, sort of positional conventions. And it worked to treat, you know, curbing Saka and then adding so much to the attack as well. And then off the pitch, he's choosing the Fergie route, I suppose, which is marshalling the fan base, circling the wagons, throw a few more little cliches in there. But that thing where he's decided to draw energy from this, he's decided to portray Manchester City as underdogs, which is some intellectual leap, but he manages it. And he's galvanizing people, which is what he does. And, you know, in those terms, whether you agree with him or disagree with him on his attitude towards City being charged by the Premier League, if you remove that and just look at it in management terms and those, it's a tour de force.
Yeah, certainly. You know, when I saw him a couple of weeks ago, I got a real sense that he's ready to pull as many rabbits as he needed out of the hat. And, you know, I'm grateful for you to try and describe Bernardo Silva's position. It was almost like a sort of a, you know, an inverted left back who then became a sort of boxy midfield. It was just great to behold. And I suppose, Paul, that brings us to the, you know, one of our classic tropes, which is Guardiola being so determined to win the Champions League, he overthinks everything. Next week, they're in Leipzig to play, you know, Red Bull Leipzig. What's he going to come up with now?
Yeah, I love watching him. You know, in games, in little moments, he goes into these wild gesticulation modes where he drags a couple of players over to the touchline and he's flashing his hands around and pointing and jabbing his fingers and giving them positional instructions that to most of us are just incomprehensible. But I mean, the players nod and drop back on and do the job. I mean, it's a kind of, we know it's a kaleidoscopic system in the sense that every player on that pitch is multi-talented and they are flexible and adaptable. So he has that in his favour. It's not as if he's turning average players into you know, total footballers. But at the same time, his little dash of genius will make the difference most of the time. Sometimes it undermines him, as we've seen in some of the big Champions League knockout stages. But he must be looking at the Champions League now and thinking that, we say this every year, don't we? City will never have a better chance of winning the Champions League than this year. But I was looking at the odds, Mike, and would you believe that Liverpool and Real Madrid are both 10-1 to win the Champions League? The two dominant teams in the market are Manchester City and Bayern Munich. So if the bookmakers know anything and the data crunchers know anything, they're saying that if Man City perform at the level they have in the last two games, for example, you know, Bayern Munich will be their biggest opponents in this year's competition. So at City, they must be feeling the sap rising again and thinking, you know, this could be the year when we finally become European champions.
Yeah, as you mentioned there, Paul, Liverpool actually face Real Madrid at Anfield next week in a repeat of last year's final. Now, a lot's changed in the last 9 months or so. Obviously, they're clubs with huge European pedigree, but considerable current problems. Johnny, do Liverpool in particular need a game like this and an occasion like this to actually reset their season?
Yeah, I think they do need this game to be big. They might have already had that reset, though, in the Mersey Derby. I'm going to be really interested to see how they perform at Newcastle at the weekend, because in that Mersey Derby, for the first time in a long time, that golden Liverpool word intensity was back. And I think unity from fans to players was back. There was just an extra edge to everything they did that had been lacking, and a renewed sort of sense of purpose, I think, about Klopp and his communications around the game. And I delved into this in an article, and the soundings I have taken suggest that Klopp has kind of reached his kind of rock bottom of this season, and he's come back out of it, and he is re-energized, and he is ready to, like Pep, fight for everything he's built in the second half of this season, and has renewed belief that Liverpool can transition successfully, because that's what they're doing. They're trying to transition to a new team. You know, he's more confident than that. I think he feels he can bring in reinforcements in the summer and all the rest of it. So I kind of feel that maybe the curve is starting to come up for Liverpool. But one of the factors I think they've battled this season is going into it, having come so close to that quadruple, coming so close to another title, beaten by City in the final few minutes of last season, and then starting the season badly, I think two wins in the first seven games, and realizing their title hopes were over by, you know, middle of September. And as someone close to the situation said, it was like letting the air out of the balloon for those players. Asking Liverpool players to go and fight for fourth place isn't going to get their juices going. The Champions League will get their juices going. Now, if they can conjure a great Anfield night against Real Madrid on top of an upturn in the league, then suddenly the rest of the season looks completely different. They've got another Champions League to go for, and they can go and, you know, push up back up into the upper reaches of the Premier League. But going out of the Champions League, I think, would kill their season, and it might put them back psychologically to the state they've been in.
When you think about it, Klopp's leadership qualities have come through, certainly in response to that report highlighting UEFA's role in, you know, what was termed dangerous chaos at the last final in Paris. You know, he was speaking of lies in connection to that, Paul. If you're going to make that connection with your fans, you can't do it in a more evocative way, can you?
No. I would have expected Jurgen Klopp to see it that way. I think anybody would. It was the treatment of Liverpool fans at that game was outrageous. In fact, all fans, all spectators at that game was outrageous. And it really focused attention on how the live spectator has just been treated, turned into an extra by the governing bodies. You know, just a horde of people that can be treated any way you want to treat them, because they're just noise in the background for TV and streaming companies. And it was a real watershed, I think, that Champions League final. I hope it was. And I don't think it will make any difference to Liverpool's season or how they play, but Jurgen Klopp is always an articulate analyst of those sorts of off-the-pitch issues, and that's one of the many reasons Liverpool are lucky to have him. I think on the pitch, I'd like to see a bit more evidence that they've turned this corner, because when I watched them against Wolves and against Brighton recently, a lot of the players looked detached to me, looked like they'd lost interest. They weren't doing their jobs. They weren't doing the basics. And it was quite shocking to see Liverpool players so almost with the white flag up. And I think if a Merseyside derby doesn't get you going again, nothing will. So I'd like to see them sustain that form over a longer period before I'm convinced that actually Liverpool have re-engaged. But the signs, as Johnny said, were certainly promising.
Johnny, what do you make of Madrid? More Champions League titles than La Liga titles in the last decade, which is some stat to get your head around. You know, there's a familiar cycle of recrimination going on there, isn't there? Trailing Barcelona by 8 points even after a comfortable win on Wednesday night. Ancelotti under pressure despite his achievements, including that latest empty World Club Cup win. Madrid, you can never write them off, but, and there is a but this time, isn't there?
I think there is. I mean, look, Ancelotti's been here before. He's won Champions Leagues and then been sacked the following season before. Let's face it, this is the Madrid cycle, as you mentioned, Mike. And rather like the old firm in Scotland, Madrid and Barcelona live in each other's kind of, in a sort of symbiotic relationship or whatever, it's probably the wrong word. But they you know, they live in comparison to each other perpetually. And partly Ancelotti's problem is that Barcelona are having such a great season, such a regenerative season under Xavi. But on the pitch, there've been wobbles in form. There've been some limp defeats. They haven't really contested the title race properly. What was always going to happen is happening, which is the end of a certain generation. Modric is not playing such a big part. Casemiro's already gone. Cruz as well. So that was always the issue that was going to really bite them. Benzema scored a couple on Wednesday, and you know, he's had injury problems, but he may still have one great sort of finale to the campaign in him. But they're not the Madrid of last season. Caveat, of course, is that last season we saw them coming out of a slump early in the year to somehow win, you know, three ties on the bounce against Premier League teams who you thought would beat anyone in front of them the way they were playing, any European team, but Madrid found ways to do it. So of course we can't write them off, but I don't think they're quite what they were in winning it last year.
Hmm. I mentioned the World Club Cup pool is going to have 24 teams in 2025. This year's version is going to be in Saudi Arabia. Surprise, surprise. Speaking of which, Newcastle, that game against Liverpool at the weekend, is that a potential top four decider?
Yeah, it could be. I think what we're seeing with Newcastle is that they've overachieved and the depth of their squad isn't big enough to sustain really a top four challenge. They might finish in the top four places, but they're starting to struggle. Three draws in a row against Crystal Palace, West Ham and Bournemouth. The form has dipped a bit. Liverpool's form is improving. You know, the sensible way to look at that game, I suppose, would be to expect a Liverpool win unless Newcastle can kind of restore their momentum, the excellent momentum that Eddie Howe's built up. I mean, on your point about Saudi Arabia, Mike, I'm almost looking at these events now and wondering whether FIFA are actually taking decisions that favour Saudi Arabia rather than the other way around. It's not an accident. There's a pattern here. The Saudi State Tourism Authority is sponsoring the 2023 Women's World Cup. The men's tournament is expected to go there in 2030. And as you said, Club World Cup is a 24-team Club World Cup is probably going to be in Saudi Arabia. So there is an incredible pattern at the heart of FIFA, which they probably hope we're not noticing, but we are. And their team, Newcastle United, are even dressing as Saudi Arabia in their mm-hmm. away kit. People have become inured to that now, but I watched them the other night away from home and I thought that they just looked like Saudi Arabia. And it's amazing how quickly that becomes the norm, how things that were once shocking become accustomed to. I mean, I was going to say we all need to remain vigilant, but that's weasel words in a way, because you need to be more than vigilant, don't you?
Yeah. Chelsea, completely different model, Johnny. One win in nine, not scored in 8 out of 13. They dominate, but they don't penetrate. When will patience wear thin?
Well, I hope the answer to that question is a long time from now, because I think it'd be preposterous to commit to this project with a whole load of new players, young players, and a manager that you've asked to come in and do something completely different, which is actually to build a sort of, you know, viable and lasting, sustainable culture, and a manager that is finding his feet at a bigger stage in Graham Potter. So I hope it's a long time, but experience tells you, and I'm not going to use the cliche, it's Chelsea, so they sack managers. Actually, it's more when owners invest lots of money in new players and the team doesn't deliver quickly, owners tend to get itchy, and I hope that's not what's going to happen here. That said, there are issues that I think Graham Potter needs to show his mettle by addressing, and you've touched on them, Mike. The lack of penetration and goals is damning. At Brighton, some people call them the XG King, disparagingly, and there's a danger that Chelsea are going down a similar route. The alarm bells for me would be Mudrik hasn't yet looked like he's they have a role for him. He's a £90 million player. He's a transformative player. He doesn't quite look like that yet. And, you know, I watched the Manchester City Arsenal game and then flipped over to Chelsea, and I had to kind of, I was blinking, looking, oh, there's Ruben Loftus-Cheek, there's Hakim Ziyech. You know, it was like looking at Chelsea before all the spending, and I was thinking, where are all the new players? So there are questions that it's really difficult for Potter, but I think he needs to quickly decide a best 11 and a best route to goal.
Yeah, you mentioned ownership and the, you know, associated egocentricity of that role. Todd Boehly was spotted in Paris watching PSG, inevitably perhaps linked then with Neymar. Now, Paul, that's just absurd to even contemplate someone who essentially is recreating walking football in the Champions League.
Yeah, it would be an entirely superficial thing to do, wouldn't it? A thing based entirely on commerce, because...
It's probably likely then, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I've just made it happen. If Graham Potter has 25 players and an incredibly difficult job in trying to work out what his best 11 is and where they should all play, the last thing he needs is Neymar walking into the middle of that and saying, everything revolves around me. You know, this is all about me. I mean, you could talk about destabilisation of Chelsea. Well, that's already happening with the scattergun transfer policy. But to make a shallow, you know, move of that nature would just finish it off, really. And I'm not convinced they're going to try and do it. And if they do, well, they'll get what they deserve.
Mm. Well, Chelsea are at home to Southampton on Saturday, Johnny. So I suppose they can look at them and think, well, things could be worse.
Oh, wow. I know we're having a right season for soap operas at football clubs. At Southampton are a prime example. I mean, the brief and strange reign of Nathan Jones is now over. Southampton are now in Leeds territory in more than one way, because their new manager search has quickly run into farce, and they're relying on an assistant. So then, of course, you think, well, why have you sacked a manager without any idea what you were going to do next? But clubs do this time and time again. What I feel sorry for with Southampton, I saw them at the start of the season, and they have signed some really, really good young footballers. You know, Bella Kotchap, for example. The forwards, really good players, Bazunu in goal. You know, they've collected some talent there, and you thought there was an opportunity to grow a really good team, and it looks rather like that the kind of survival battle is going to kind of rip up that project a little bit before it even got going. And I feel sorry for those young players, because it must be really difficult for them. But I have to say the last couple of weeks' events give even less confidence that Southampton are going to stay up.
Mm. Just a final look at some of the European issues, Paul. Spurs, you know, lost in Milan. Antonio Conte, do you get any sense that we're approaching the end game with him?
I do, really. I mean, Spurs fans have been grumpy for various reasons for many years, possibly decades, but they're very grumpy about Conte. And there is this idea taking hold that Conte is somehow dated, and that the one big idea he has doesn't work anymore in the Premier League, that the Premier League is different, and that he's playing his own game, and it's not an effective game given the nature of the, you know, the talents of the opposition. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. You don't watch Spurs and think that's a good idea. You know, they have plenty of good players, but no idea with what to do to them, with them in a tactical or strategic sense. So once that idea takes hold, I think, you know, you'll both sides will recognise it, I think, at some point, and Conte will feel that he wants to go back to Italy, and Spurs will feel that they're stuck and they can't make the next move until they bring somebody in who's more attuned to how the Premier League is these days.
Mm. So, Johnny, a semi-detached manager of a flawed team, is that an approximation of the truth, or is that too unkind?
It's looked like that at times. No, it's probably not unkind. And if that's unkind on Conte, then he's kind of made that impression himself by the noises, the continual sort of things aren't quite what I want to hear noises. And that can't have helped. The Harry Kane situation in some ways doesn't help. I don't blame Harry Kane for that, but the club's got itself into a position where the talisman's future yet again isn't really decided. And then the thing that we've touched on, just that tension between Conte's ideas and the traditions, if you want to call it that way, or the aspirations, might be a better word, of Spurs supporters for the kind of football they want to play. So that unity, fans, board, players, manager, doesn't seem to be there at the moment.
And it wouldn't be modern football, Paul, would it, without a heavily trailed supposed bid in excess of $3 billion from an Iranian-American financier. As I said, heavily trailed, but no contact yet. You know, there's the noises coming out of Spurs is that there's no desire to actually sell the club. As I said, that's modern football writ large yet again.
Yes, you have to work on the assumption that every Premier League club is basically for sale because all the owners have decided the ceiling hasn't yet been reached and they all think they can squeeze more juice out of it. I'd be interested to ask you two, when Enoch took Spurs over many, many years ago now, nobody thought that they were going to be in it for the long haul. They've been in it longer than anyone thought they would be. But you always felt that Spurs would be for sale at some point, that this was a quick turnover operation. You know, maybe it's just taken longer than we thought, but the stadium is a big issue, isn't it? Because, you know, having built that stadium, you'd want a heck of a lot of money to compensate you for all the hassle that caused and all the investment you put in. So it would be a high price. But again, I start from the position that they're all for sale.
Yeah, well, to answer your point there, Paul, someone told me recently, someone who's had personal experience of the American entrepreneurs coming in, especially, where, you know, essentially it's a three-pronged 10-year project. You've got the initial real estate value and potential there. You've got the commercial potential. And then somewhere third, you've got the sporting dimension to it. So, you know, we're looking at big business principles coming into football, which, you know, frankly, is no great surprise to any of us, is it?
No, completely. That's the analysis they're all making, I'm sure.
Yeah. Spurs, of course, are at home to West Ham on Sunday. It will be David Moyes' 644th Premier League game as a manager. Only Arsene Wenger and Sir Alex Ferguson have been in charge of more. Now, he's not a man for such statistics, but whatever your allegiance, you must admit that they represent a great body of work. Welcome, David. When Jurgen Klopp came on the podcast, I asked him what was the greatest lesson that he could impart from his 1,000 games to a manager starting off on game one. Now, it's 25 years since you began at Preston. What would you say to the same question? What answer would you give?
I don't think I could turn around and give you one answer, but probably the one I need to do is you need to try and be successful in your first job if you can, because that would give you the chance to get towards 1,000. If you're probably not successful in your first job, it becomes much harder. But as well as that, I think if you don't love the game, then I think that you'll probably never get to 1,000 games. You have to have an incredible love for the game, that it drives you on. Because behind the scenes, for all the managers and for all the... it's a long, hard road. You're losing a lot of family time. So for me, winning if you get a first job would be how you win. Does it matter? Maybe. Not as much as getting the wins, but I think if you don't love the game, then you'll never go on to get 1,000.
The fallout rate from the first job is frightening. It was over 50%.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, somehow or other, you know, you have to find a way of getting yourself your foot in the ladder. And what you shouldn't do is think that you put your sort of feet under the table and that's you've got the job and you don't need to work anymore. Actually, the minute you get the job is how you find, you know, more information, where you go for good advice, where you go. And there's so many things nowadays where you can do it. But I remember know, the early years when I was a manager at Preston North End, when I got my first job, I was out looking to see, I'd done all my coaching badges, but I was out everywhere trying to find where I could get more information, going to try and watch teams training. As a younger coach, I was trying to go and watch the national team, see if I could get in, see what it was like, just to pick up ideas. And I think that's what I mean. I think when you get in the job, if you think, hey, I've done this, that's great, I've got a job now, I think that's where you'll be kidding yourself on if you don't think this is really just where the hard work begins.
Mm. How do you think the game's changed, or the job has changed specifically over the last 25 years?
Look, the job has definitely changed. I think the way you communicate now is probably one of the biggest things I find. You know, even, for example, we were discussing this, you know, how I communicate as a manager to you or how I communicate to the media. But more importantly, how you communicate to your players nowadays, I think, is a big part of communication. If I go back to the days when, you know, I was a player, or maybe in the early days, you know, you used to try and stay away from the manager's office. You didn't go near his door. You tried to, you'd nod your head maybe, but it maybe wasn't quite as good a sort of communication as what it is nowadays. And I think that there's lots of other parts of the game. You know, we've got all the players, I've got a team around them, you know, there's much more, you know, some of them have podcasts as well, you know, some of them are doing other things in their life as well. So I think the job's become much harder. Their agent's involvement obviously has changed a lot of ways how you would want to do your business correctly, because it makes it much harder when the agent's out there touting your players to go to other clubs.
Mm, because the financial incentives are so huge now. You know, you get examples. Someone was talking to me recently about Vinicius Junior at Real Madrid, where, you know, he has two childhood friends with him, live-in chef, live-in sports scientist, who basically the scientist operates off the data that the club give him on a particular day. Yeah. So in other words, there's a performance cell, mm-hmm. if you like, yeah. built around one player.
Yeah.
Is that the way it's going, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I would say. I hope it wasn't. You know, they all want to go back to their own countries for maybe operations or medical treatment, even though all the clubs supply terrific medical professionals. But it's often, quite often, that they choose that they've got somewhere else where they think they can be treated quicker, better, or better advice maybe at times. So I do think that they're all getting to that. I hope it doesn't go as far as what you sort of mean, that, because it would take everything away. You know, I'm hearing some people having, you know, their own fitness coaches and different things. And I'm saying, well, I can see maybe in the off season why you would have that, but no, you wouldn't have it during the season when obviously we are preparing the players and getting them ready for games, etc., etc.
With the, you know, you mentioned the players. Now, obviously, you've got the challenge of dealing with them, you know, managing millennials as well, different breed of individual. There's also been a lot of talk about player burnout, and, you know, the emotional vulnerability of the modern player. As a manager, do you have to have almost the strong moral compass and also a real degree of sort of like emotional intelligence, for want of a better phrase?
I think you need all of them. I think the players nowadays are changed. I think being a manager, you need to have all of them. I think you need to show the values to the players. They want to see your values as a man, as a coach, you know, as a leader. All those things come into it. So I think to go into coaching, I think you get your coaching badges. But I think having leadership qualities, you know, motivational qualities, emotional qualities with players. You know, there's some of the coaches are terrific dealing individually with players. There'll be others who are maybe not so good. So I think that all those points are valid in going on to become a successful coach or manager. But even them, I could say to you, you might be very good at all them, but if you don't get that winning formula to win on a Saturday, then none of them might work.
Okay, going back to something you said earlier about, as a young coach, that thirst for knowledge. Now, you quite famously compiled notes on the tactics and the techniques of managers that you'd seen or coaches that you'd seen. Out of all the coaches that you did observe, who had the greatest influence on you?
Oh, there's loads of coaches. I was a huge admirer. Obviously, I was brought up in the Scottish SFA system. I'd done the English one as well when I was younger, coach as well. But I have to say, at the time, the Scottish managers, you know, were obviously Sir Alex is even, but Jock Steen, Sir Matt Busby, Bill Shankly, so many of the of the Scottish manager. George Graham, strange enough as well, you know, was sort of one of the modern ones. And if you look back at the Scottish managers who used to come down, and you know, even people like George Burley, Gordon Strachan, you know, who've all managed in the Premier League, and there's many, many more.
And they all came out of Largs, is it Largs?
All out of Largs with the coaching system. But the guy who set Largs up was, in my mind, in my era, was Andy Roxburgh. Mm. And Andy Roxburgh was probably Scotland's first really modern coach, if you wanted to put it that way, and he'd done a great job. And I was really intrigued by how they worked. But I have to say, in those early days when I was a young boy, you know, we had, you know, Walter Smith, you know, there was Jim McLean, there was Jockey Scott, there was Sir Alex, there was so many of the great Scottish managers would come down and give their time up for young coaches like myself or young players at the time. And they would give up a couple of weeks of the summertime to come down and help them prepare and help them with the management. So I admired so many. But I think as I sort of got to an age where I was beginning to sort of look to see what was out, I was a great lover of Terry Venables because I liked the way he managed, I liked his teams. And then obviously there was Brian Clough and Sir Bobby and people like that who had the legacies in England, I think, with their clubs, you know, who'd been in charge of teams for a long time. The Nottingham Forest teams that won the sort of the European Cups and whatnot would had great teams and they were great to watch.
Yeah, it's funny, we had Martin O'Neill on last week. Do you think, in terms of when you're looking at football, isn't it a constant process of renewal anyway?
Oh, huge. If you think that you can stand still, I actually think that, you know, I've been out of the game a few times, I've been out of work, and I actually think that the minute you're out, you nearly lose touch. It moves on that fast. You know, the stuff that's going on behind the scenes, the amount of work there is, no looking at players, no analysing what's out there, how it goes. And, you know, for a lot of people who don't do football management, you know, maybe it sounds like a job, you know, that you can sort of come in and you're away every day at 2 o'clock. I have to say, I couldn't see where it's further from the truth from that. It really isn't. It's absolutely 24/7 and, you know, you're nearly every day of the week now. So from my point of view, I think that, you know, if you're going into football management and you're going to be in it, it's a really, really tough job.
Mm. Is this where experience comes in? Because, you know, there's so much noise around the game and the job that you do and others do. You know, there's always this staple that, you know, there's always one manager, in inverted commas, under pressure every week, and you see the pantomime around that. When Brendan Rodgers was going through it, I asked him how he dealt with it, and he just said, everything becomes automated. You know, you've been there before, you just know what you're doing. In your position, has your experience enabled you to have a perspective on, you know, some of the stuff that's gone over the last six, 8 weeks?
Hugely. Huge perspective, because I think to myself, as West Ham have had three brilliant seasons. We avoided relegation. We take them into Europe the next year. We get to the semi-final of European competition. We finish seventh the second year. So the perspective has made me saying is, yeah, you know, if you're going to come to West Ham and expect to do 6-7 years where you're competing at the top, well, I think you're probably kidding yourself on. And I think MD or any real football intelligence would probably go along with that, because you just look at the size at the moment, you know, look at the form of Newcastle. And other teams are entitled to. Brighton have had an incredible run in what they've done. You know, Brentford and Fulham are doing so well this year with their. So you've got no entitlement to be there all the time. And when you are a club which you've probably never been there, well, there's a good chance that you could easily drop out of it. So we've had a couple of incredible years, which has meant I'm more relaxed. And, you know, if it didn't work here at West Ham, then fine, you know, you take it and that would be it. But the biggest thing for me at West Ham is I see it having that much potential to improve, get better, and be one of a real major club. It is a major club, but become a real challenging club. I see it. And I think for the last couple of years, we've proved that. This year, we're not doing quite so well.
Mm. Because we are, though, in an age of state-sponsored football with everything that comes with that. I think that's probably only going to intensify. And certainly the financial, perhaps, inequalities. Mm-hmm. Given that, how does a club of West Ham's stature and tradition deal with that and make itself relevant to the future?
I think as a football club, I think that's why I think there's so much room for improvement. I think we can do things better here, and I think that in the future, hopefully I'll be able to help them or guide them and show them a way where I think we should be going forward and use my experience to help that. I mean, I think that there's some clubs following some pathways, so a Brighton or a Brentford might be following a different route than maybe other clubs. But I think you're right about how does a West Ham compete now with the spending powers of maybe three or four clubs in the Premier League. We probably don't have that spending power. So what we've got to try and do then is find a way of getting good players, identifying them early, us working them in. And you have to also have a belief that money is not always going to be the reason why you're successful in football. If you do, then I'm not saying that I wouldn't want to be involved in if it was that, but I would want to hope that there was a chance out there for smaller teams to get better or for teams with not as much money to win it. Leicester City won the league a few years ago and we're seeing, for example, Arsenal this year not being talked about really. I don't know if there was any pundit or one pundit who named Arsenal as possible Premier League winners. So that means that the football does change and it is unpredictable. So I think we've got to hope that the clubs who are getting all the money then it doesn't always work for them.
Because in essence, it does come down a lot of the time to what you do on the grass out there, doesn't it? Do you see yourself as a teacher first and then maybe some form of senior executive second?
Mm-hmm. I think you're all that. I think now when I get age, I mean, I hope that when I'm, I'd love to be probably a coach educator when I finish. You know, if I finish being a manager, I'd love to be involved in coaching because it's what I like doing. I like listening to it. I love talking to football people about things that are going on. But are you a teacher? Yeah, I think you're a teacher. And a lot of things now is being the manager, is being a teacher in modern life. You know, there's a lot of different situations behind the scenes which go on. There's a lot of mental health issues which mean that suddenly you have to be totally educated in how you speak and how you deal with people who've got some other problems. So being that manager, being that coach comes with lots of different diverse jobs.
Mm. And you said earlier on, as a final question, you have to love the game. What gets you up in the morning?
Always getting me up was the thought of going training and having the training ready for the players and trying to put on the best sessions and the best preparation I possibly could. Being prepared. Also to make it enjoyable, but more importantly, to make sure that I feel as if that I came off smiling myself as a coach because I thought I got something out of that I needed to get in today. I got an element of today's practice gave me something which will help me towards a result or help me towards something in the Saturday. So that's probably the thing that pushes me on. And look, I've got to say, loving the game means that you got, imagine coming in and training with some of the best football players. I've got some incredible footballers, England internationals, Brazilian internationals, Italian internationals, and getting the chance to work with them. Hey, have fun with them as well. But
after all this time, do you still get a wow moment when you see, I don't know, someone take the ball down in a certain way or whatever?
Yeah, I still certainly do. But my biggest wow moment was Wayne Rooney when I was 16-year-old. And I'm only saying it because I still talk about it, Wayne scoring in training and us all looking round at each other saying, did he really do that? You know what I mean? When he's only 16. So, you know, you've had those wow moments. But I think now I'm looking for, you know, I'm hoping to get success. I'm still driven by the best is still to come. I've still got room for a trophy in my house somewhere, if you know what I mean. I've still got room to try and get another few games in if it's possible. So I'm driven by that to keep that going and in the hope that somewhere we come out on top of it.
Well, all the best to you, David. Thanks.
Thank
for
you.
That.
Thank you. Thank you. Cheers.
So, Johnny, you know him very well. Now, I was struck by how at ease he felt, despite the recent problems. Is this a case of vast experience giving him really clear perspective?
I think it is, Mike, that came through. I really enjoyed listening to David sounding so much at ease as himself there. And that's been my experience of conversations with him in recent years, that he's in a really so happy place, I think, in his managerial career, having had the big knock of the Manchester United experience, which would knock anybody. But I think his juices came back a long time ago, and feeling that he's found something in West Ham that he can affect positively, finding new adventures with them building something there has really been a joy to David. And one of the things that really struck me in your interview was him talking about when you asked, you know, advice for young managers or how do you sort of construct a managerial career? And he said, you have to love it. You have to love it. That's the key thing. And his love for the game's been well documented there from the start. Famously, the guy that as a player would drive up and down the country trying to go to evening games, preparing for a managerial career. He's always had a ferocious work ethic. But I think as an older manager, he's managed to balance that a little bit more with having a proper life, with perspective, understanding that football's fickle, but you can affect the people around you and the teams you manage in a positive way, and you focus on that. That, you know, he's quite sanguine, I think, about the ownership at West Ham. He's quite grateful to them. Now, that's not what one might expect from the outside. You know, those owners don't have the best reputation, but David understands this is football, and they've actually backed him in difficult times. And if the results aren't there, then things might change. But he's been through he's been through the mill now. He knows all that. And I think perspective, but retaining the love is put him in that the state that you drew out of him in that interview.
Yeah, what I found fascinating, Paul, was when he talked about, you know, maybe once management is over, becoming a coach educator. And the thing that went through my mind was that, you know, I was wondering, especially with the way that West Ham's going to evolve, whether or not he would end up almost as a sort of a technical director at a club like that. Where do you think his future lies? And do you think, you know, I mentioned, you know, the great names, Wenger and Ferguson, is he actually underestimated as a manager?
Yeah, I think he was very shrewd in that interview with you, Mike, to spell out the good times that West Ham have had recently. And he isolated this season as a sort of bit of a regression. But he set out the progress he's made there very well. I mean, as for educating, you know, there's a fetishization in modern football of data, of analysis, of specialist coaching. And sometimes all that obscures the kind of universal human elements, the human values that you have, I think, to be a good manager or a coach. And David Moyes is a bridge back to some methods and philosophies that are sometimes not laughed at, but dismissed as antiquated. But, you know, his vast knowledge of the game from the bottom to the top, and his experience of working with countless people, players and coaches and professionals within the game, has to have a use. It has to have merit, because if you discard people with knowledge and experience, you know, you end up just putting yourself in the hands of, as I say, the analysts and the data specialists and the people who think that football is all about, you know, numbers and statistics. So I suppose what I'm saying is that David Moyes has a lot of wisdom and a lot of experience, and people like him should have a role in the game when they're no longer just managing first 11s.
Mm. He's very realistic, Johnny, about West Ham's place in the food chain, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. You know, you don't manage the third most games in the Premier League without knowing what the food chain looks like. And I'd suggest that he's brought West Ham, not this year, but last year, to more or less the top of where they could, you know, get because of that place in the food chain. But I think that's part of management as well, which is having ambition, but understanding what's possible and then going for that and being realistic. And one thing you'll always find from David is utter realism. And I think that actually comes out of the experience that Paul was talking about there, and out of the traditions he comes from, the football background, education system at Largs in Scotland, the figures he's learnt from, like Walter Smith and Sir Alex Ferguson and Andy Roxburgh, who he mentions. There's a sort of Scottish common sense that is passed down into coaching, and allied with ambition and fight has made Scots successful managers over the years. But, you know, maybe David's one of the last ones, sadly, at the top level that we've produced.
Yeah, well, finally, and with due apologies for raising this grotesque subject yet again, I suppose by common consensus, Paul, West Ham got away with one with VAR, you know, when Suchek sort of trialled as a replacement goalkeeper against Chelsea. VAR, that was part of probably the worst weekend for the, you know, that benighted system last weekend. It's really wobbling, isn't it? And let's discuss, if we could, whether this system is actually worth retaining.
Well, good question. Over the past 3 weeks, we've seen four sort of calamitous errors across different parts of the game. So you had Fabinho going through the back of Evan Ferguson at Brighton, 18-year-old lad, left the ground in a brace, and Fabinho wasn't sent off. That's a VAR blunder. Then you have Suchek playing goalkeeper on the floor for West Ham and not being penalised for it. And then, most contentiously possibly, you've got the offside line being drawn in the wrong place twice. So you've got four major issues there. You've got tackling, you've got handball, and you've got offsides, with VAR failing in all four cases. And Howard Webb was sort of commendably honest and open about that, and called the referees in to try and say, you know, this isn't good enough, we need to be better. But he raised the spectre when he said that when he talked about human error, because human error and VAR are an oxymoron. VAR was supposed to eliminate human error, not add to human error. So Howard Webb there, I think, opened the door to people saying, well, if VAR still has human errors, bad human errors built into it, then maybe VAR is the problem. Do you see what I mean? He sort of let a bit too much light in on magic there. And this is where the debate has gone now, where people are saying, well, okay, if it can't be run properly, it shouldn't be run at all. I don't subscribe to that. I think it works better in Europe. I think there's a problem with the people running it in this country. And I think that it's far exceeded its brief, which is something we've said very often on this podcast and in other places. It's out of control. It's not just dealing with the obvious, clear and obvious errors in the game. And it's turned offside, particularly into a forensics exercise where every time there's a goal, you just sit and wait for the inquest. And that is a fundamental diminution of the enjoyment of watching live football. So I can't believe that anybody would think that it's working properly or acceptable in its present form.
Yeah, and have we been missing a point, Johnny, that, you know, being VAR is a distinctive skill, and it's a skill set that the old guard, who basically are shuffled off to Stockley Park to do their Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon duty, don't understand fully. We almost need a culture shift in refereeing and a new breed of referee who actually operates in isolation from the game almost. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And it struck me as odd right from the start that referees who aren't able to referee anymore, you shove them into Stockley Park. What? Why? You know, surely it's not a retirement job. It's as important as anything else in this day and age. So absolutely, we probably need referees who are specifically trained in VAR. I mean, my starting point would be, I don't think we're better for having VAR. I wish it had never come in, but it is here now. So I think we've got to deal with that reality, and it needs to be streamlined. As Paul said, it and human error shouldn't coexist. So I think the streamlining needs to be, have VAR for completely binary decisions, which would be, you know, handballs, goals and on offsides. But there also needs to be a redrawing of the laws, I think, because one of the problems that VAR's struck is it's coming at a time when there's been a lot of tinkering with particularly the handball law and particularly the offside law. And what we saw at Arsenal, which was a game I was at, was really it wasn't the technology, it was a failure to interpret the laws properly, which is alarming, let's face it, very alarming, and that's a human error on a big scale. But if the simply for the refs, it's trying to marry these two things together. So I think offside needs to be really simplified, and I think we need to have clarity on handball. And I wouldn't have VAR for the other stuff. It's always struck me that the referee on the pitch is the best person to decide whether a foul is reckless or not, because what TV doesn't show you are things like impact and context, not properly. So I'm very comfortable And I think that aspect's been better this season, actually. We've seen fewer pernickety pulling back fouls because TV seems to make the foul look worse than it actually was. That's fine, but I wouldn't get VAR involved in that at all. Offsides and handballs, but the laws need to be simplified as well.
Yeah, well, let's be clear. VAR has changed the very nature of the game. Its flow's interrupted, its joy is denied. The basic attraction of celebrating a goal has been reduced to an afterthought or a temporary indulgence. Now, I admire Howard Webb and his transparent approach, but look at the organisation that he represents. Like FIFA, it's introspective and has little apparent appetite for dealing with mistakes. It seems happy to defend the damage that VAR is doing, and that can't be right. You know, it's no surprise that observers of the stature of Paul and Johnny share my doubts. Thanks to them, and of course to David Moyes, old school values still count for something, you know.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.